Hello, this is Chris English welcoming you to another edition of At Home This Morning.
A magazine programme that we hope will provide you with a look at our world, both in and around the city of Brighton and Hove and further afield, all for both our older listeners and those not so old. In the next hour, we'll be hearing from Chichester Festival Theatre's Lucinda Morrison about their plans for the forthcoming season, and what a treat that has in store. We'll also be joined by food historian Polly Russell with news on just why we all love a good pie. On the medical front, we'll be hearing from Dr. Zoe Williams again about why it's important that mums and grandmums catch up on weaning newborn babies, following some new advice from the NHS. And if you're a commuter or know someone who is, there'll be some info on workplace choices that might make you think about where and how you work. And to return to musical theatre, there'll be news of a show that's coming to the Theatre Royal in Brighton shortly that's a must for all fans of singer-songwriter Carole King. But to get things moving, I took a trip to Chichester Festival Theatre, where I spoke to Lucinda Morrison about my delight that their summer season will see the return of Charlie Stemp, who'll be starring in a favourite of mine, namely George and Ira Gershwin's Crazy for You.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that, Chris, and it's lovely to see you here again after so long. But yes, we're really thrilled about Crazy for You. I think it's what everybody needs is a real tonic, a totally hilarious, entertaining, uplifting musical, which is just filled with almost every classic Gershwin melody you can think of. You know, I've got Rhythm and obviously Crazy for You, Someone to Look Over Me, you know, so many great tunes. And it's going to be directed and choreographed by Susan Stroman. And if you don't know her name, well, she is absolute Broadway royalty. I think she's won more Olivier Awards than almost anybody else. She's an absolutely amazing director and choreographer. And we're particularly thrilled that Charlie Stemp, who really sprang to stardom in Half a Sixpence here in 2016, is coming back to play the lead role.
Wow. And because he's gone on from strength to strength, hasn't he, after Half a Sixpence?
Yes, absolutely. Having taken Half a Sixpence to the West End, he then went to Broadway and starred in Hello, Dolly, opposite Bette Midler and Bernadette Peters. And then he's come back. He's done three of the big London Palladium pantos at Christmas. And for the last several months, or year or so, he's been Bert in Mary Poppins, Cameron McIntosh's production of Mary Poppins in the West End. And he's actually leaving that role specifically to come back and do this in Chichester.
Wow, he must have enjoyed the time at Chichester.
Well, he said he did a little interview for us the other day, and he just said it feels like coming back home to him. He has such fond memories of Chichester. Because as I said, I mean, it was one of those very rare sort of overnight, almost like a star is born things that suddenly he really made his name here. And so, yeah, I think he's as delighted to be coming back as we are delighted that he is coming back.
Very much so. And the musical, of course, is only part of the programme for the Festival Theatre.
Yes, it is. I mean, the musical is always the centrepiece of the programme. It's what a lot of people associate Chichester with, unsurprisingly, because a lot of them, like last year's South Pacific, then go on tour into the West End. South Pacific is doing a big tour around the UK this year and will be at Sadler's Wells in the summer. But yes, we always try and offer, you know, as far as we can, something for everything, so everybody. So we've actually got two other musicals, one of which is a new musical specifically for families. It's called The Famous Five, and it's based on the Enid Blyton novels that, you know, are still enormously popular, and I'm sure many people remember from their own childhoods. And that's a lovely, you know, adventure story about young people, so for ages of about seven and up. Then there's another new musical called Local Hero, based on the Bill Forsyth film, about a Texan oil executive who's sent to Scotland to buy up a village, basically, which has music by Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits fame. But then there's all sorts of plays. I mean, we're opening the season with a new play called The Taxidermist's Daughter, which is written by Kate Moss, who is an internationally best-selling novelist. But she's was born, brought up and still lives in Chichester. And it's a wonderful sort of gothic mystery, which is set in historic Chichester itself in 1912. So that's fantastic to have a new play by a woman opening the Festival Theatre and a story that's so intimately connected with Chichester and Sussex itself. We've got a couple of plays that were originally scheduled for 2020 and of course didn't happen back then. So a new play called The Unfriend, which is written by Stephen Moffat, who wrote Doctor Who and Dracula on TV. It's directed by Mark Gatiss and it's got a wonderful cast, Amanda Abington and Rhys Shearsmith and Frances Barber, all very well-known TV faces. And a new American play called The Narcissist by a very celebrated American playwright called Christopher Shin, which is about this sort of politics, really, or really sort of communication and what's involved in politics in the modern age and how, you know, we're all on social media and, you know, what that does to political campaigns and things. And then a play by Alan Ayckbourn called Woman in Mind, one of his great sort of slightly darker comedies, but which has a fabulous central role by a woman. We're going to be announcing casting for that a bit later on. And a very spectacular staging of Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express. So for all those who, you know, love a good, you know, ripping mystery and yarn, Henry Goodman, who people will remember here, who won Olivier Awards in Arturo Huey and in Yes, Prime Minister, he's coming back to play Poirot, and that's actually being directed by Jonathan Church, who was the previous artistic director here from 2016 to 2016 and had a huge number of successes. So it's lovely that he's coming back this year in what is, of course, our 60th anniversary season. And that's just a little taster. There are lots of other things as well.
You mentioned then the problems of cause by the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Are things back to normal?
We hope so. I mean, we've been much luckier than many theatres. We were able to reopen fully again last summer with South Pacific, as I said, and I think that was one of the only musicals in the country that managed to achieve a full run without losing a single performance to COVID. So we were very lucky there. And then we did some more plays in the autumn and our winter season when we have visiting shows coming in. We lost one or two, didn't happen because of COVID, but we were able pretty much to keep going throughout, including our wonderful youth theatre show at Christmas. So as I say, yes, on the whole, you know, we're very fortunate. We've kept going and we've known just how much audiences have loved coming back to the theatre. So we're hoping that will really continue this year.
And talking about audiences, is it fair to say that perhaps the grey hair is prominent amongst your audience?
Well, I mean, we love our grey-haired audience, but we also have, I mean, I think, again, because we have such a varied programme, there is something for all ages. We've got a hugely popular scheme called Prologue, which is for 16 to 30-year-olds who can get tickets for £5, just £5 to any production. It's free to sign up to, and they do lots of other special events for them as well. So that's really popular. And I think, yeah, I mean, as I say, it's for people of all ages, but we do know, I mean, talking about our 60th anniversary, we do have people in our audiences who have been coming here since 1962, who remember the very first season. And those people are very, very special to us.
The audience, has it changed generally, what people want to see?
I think, you know, people have always just wanted a really good night out. I think Chichester audiences, as I say, over the last sort of 10, 15 years, the summer musical has become a real centrepiece and attracts people from, you know, all over the country, literally. And people have always come to see really great stories and great actors, and that absolutely continues to this day.
And of course, as you say, it's a very big anniversary of yours this year. Do you think the people that were behind the creation of Chichester Festival Theatre knew what they were actually starting?
That's a very interesting question. It's fascinating because, in a way, this theatre was one of the first crowd-funded projects. It was founded just by a local optician called Leslie Evershed Martin, who was watching a programme about the Festival Theatre in Stratford, Ontario, in Canada, and thought, well, if they can do that, why can't we? Looking back, it was sort of a madcap idea, really, because Chichester only back then had a population of 24,000 people, really. And to think that you were going to build a theatre that was going to seat 1,300 people in this, you know, quiet Sussex market town, really, was extraordinary. But he just got the whole community behind him. And, of course, what really made a huge difference was persuading Laurence Olivier, who was a huge film star and theatre star at the time, to come and be the artistic director. And, of course, Olivier, who then went on to become the first director of the National Theatre the following year, he formed a company at Chichester, which went on to become the nucleus of the National Theatre Company. And you look back at that, those original company with people, obviously Olivier himself, Joan Plowright, Michael Redgrave, Sybil Thorndike, these incredible names who all came here. And a lot of very young actors, Derek Jacobi, I think, was in the second season, Ian McKellen came here in about 1965. And ever since then, this theatre has really sort of punched above its weight. I don't think it's any exaggeration to say it is the leading regional theatre in the UK. And I hope that Leslie Evershed Martin and all the people back there who were responsible for getting it going would be incredibly proud that the vision they had 60 years ago absolutely, you know, is still going strong and shining a great light today.
The theatre itself, you had a major refurbishment a few years ago. Anything else planned?
Well, yes, the Festival Theatre itself is in great shape since that big refurbishment in 2013-14. But in fact, we're sitting in the foyer now and looking around, we did take the opportunity, while we were closed during the pandemic, to have a bit of refresh, to, you know, introduce some more colours, brightly coloured cushions and things and plants and neon lighting. And we've also, and you might be able to hear in the background, some happy noises of children, because we've introduced sort of big family fun areas, and sort of there are lots of toys and books and colouring in and beanbags and things that children and families can come and enjoy during the day. And of course, just over the road, the Minerva Theatre that was added in 1989, which seats 300 people, so much smaller than the Festival Theatre. But that, as you say, you know, 1989, when that was built, there were a lot of things that, you know, weren't, that we expect today. In fact, at the moment, one of the first plays to open in the Minerva Theatre in the season is a co-production with the National Theatre of a play called Our Generation, which is looking at teenagers. They've followed 12 teenagers for 5 years to get a real picture of their lives. And one of those actors is in a wheelchair. Now, when the Minerva was built, the importance of accessibility simply wasn't thought about in the same way it is today. So, in fact, we are now doing quite a bit of work backstage in the Minerva to make sure that it is properly wheelchair accessible, so that an actor in a wheelchair can get up to the stage, that there are accessible, you know, proper accessible toilets and showers, and you can get easily from the dressing room and things. So it is a constant process of renewal, really. We're always thinking about, you know, are we welcoming enough to audiences and actors and, you know, all the technical people and freelancers. So yes, it's an ongoing process. It's never going to end, really.
And I was talking there to Lucinda Morrison, who is, of course, from Chichester Festival Theatre.
You're listening to At Home This Morning, which is a Grey Matters production for Brighton's Radio Reverb.
Now, a staple of the great British menu is a pie. But what kind of pie? Well, it depends whether you like savoury or sweet, I suppose. But we're told that apple is the nation's favourite pie. And apparently that's about 18% of people that took part in the survey. Well, to find out more, we're joined by Polly Russell, who's food historian. Good morning, Polly.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Okay, and looking forward to a pie for lunch, I think. That's the answer. But what is it that makes a pie? What can be classed as a pie?
I mean, it's a bit of a contentious issue, so we don't want to start an argument. But, I mean, in its simplest terms, it's a filling encased usually with pastry. But, of course, that raises the thorny question of the shepherd's pie and the cottage pie, which, of course, are topped with potato and are also classed as being pies. But I think, generally speaking, a pie in its most traditional sense is something encased with or topped with pastry.
Going back into history, I seem to remember learning that the dreaded Cornish pasty came about because the tin miners took it down wrapped in paper so that they could eat it without actually getting their dirty hands anywhere near the food.
That is what I'm not sure I'd call it, a dreaded Cornish pasty. It is a Cornish pasty, and yet is a pasty a pie. I'm going to leave that to the Cornish to argue over. But you're absolutely right. This kind of history of pies being portable is really important, because partly their popularity in the past was because they were a pie as a sort of vessel for storing food effectively. And they, if they're small, they're very portable. But even if they were sort of larger, they could be given as gifts if the pastry is strong enough. So absolutely, that history of the Cornish pasty and it being portable, and also it being very much a kind of food of the working poor, working class. The pie has got this amazing history that it's kind of connected both with that sort of person, so people who are on low means but need something substantial, filling, warming. But also, of course, a pie can be dressed up to be incredibly sort of opulent and excessive. So it's a very versatile sort of vehicle for food, I suppose.
And is it something that's particularly British?
Well, there are versions of pies, and of course, we can't claim that the pie is British. It's particularly Northern European, but there are versions of pies in the Middle East, but they tend to be made with pastry that's made with olive oil, and so therefore not such sturdy pastry, that kind of flaky pastry, so kind of flatter pies than the ones that we might associate with Northern Europe and particularly with Britain, which is the kind of, you know, the pie which can either stand on its own or is quite substantive.
I started by saying that apple was the favourite pie. So is there a chart of in order of favouritism?
Well, the co-op have done a piece of research, and that's indicated that although people prefer savoury pies, 61% of people say they prefer savoury pies over sweet pies, in fact, apple pie does come out top as the overall favourite pie, followed quickly by steak.
Basically, you can have whatever takes your fancy, I suppose.
Yeah, I think this is really the sort of secret to the enduring popularity of pies, both now, where apparently one in three people eat one pie a week, so it's still a very popular dish, but also, you know, throughout history, and it's to do with its versatility. You can, you know, make a pie with whatever you have, you know, left lying around, what is surplus. It allows you to kind of store and hold food, but also you can do a pie that's incredibly sort of excessive, very much about kind of showing off your pastry skills. So it's this kind of versatility of the pie. You know, the pie you eat at a football match is very different to the sort of pie you might serve up on a Christmas table, for example.
Weird and wonderful pies. I'm sure you've come across a few. What's the most unusual?
Well, it's not that this one is unusual, but it's my absolute favourite for excess. It's a pie that is in a recipe book from 1845 by a chef to the aristocracy, a chef to royalty called Francatelli. And this is his recipe for Yorkshire pie, which is a pie that would be given as a gift at Christmas or would be on very wealthy tables at Christmas. And in this pie, Chris, there are included, and this is not all the ingredients because it would take me too long to read them out, but in one single pie, he lists a whole turkey, a brace of pheasants and a small Yorkshire ham just in one pie. According to his recipe, it takes 2 days to prepare. So not much use unless you've got an army of servants.
And an army of people to eat it, I should think.
Exactly. Yeah, this is a huge pie, absolutely meant to last sort of over days, but, you know, people coming to visit over the Christmas period. But it does speak very much to this kind of British tradition of pies and of pies sort of playing their role in feasting and in also sort of a mixture between feasting, but also kind of sustenance.
Polly, as a historian, you must come across all sorts of strange things. How does this rate? I know we've just had British Pie Week, but how does it rate in your scale of things to focus on?
You know what? The thing about food, Chris, is that, first of all, everyone can be an expert about food because we all eat. So that's why I love thinking about food and talking about food. Also, it's such a great way at trying to understand the past, because if you understand what people eat, it gives you an inclination as to how they were living, you know, what their circumstances were, what they cared about. So for me, Pie Week, it sort of sounds funny, but actually it's a really nice kind of snapshot onto thinking about the past and our relationship with it.
Food historian Polly Russell was here with news of the Great British Pie. Now, there's a new NHS guidance and promotion on the way, and it's all about promoting advice for introducing babies to solid food. And we might think that's a rather strange thing to have on our programme at home this morning. Well, it may or may not be. And to find out, we're going to be joined by Dr. Zoe Williams and Charlotte Sterling Reed. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Chris.
That question, is that something that grandparents and even great-grandparents, in my case, should be involved in raising young babies?
Yes, absolutely. I think anybody who is involved in a baby's life, so, you know, parents, grandparents, other relatives, friends, I think it's useful for, as advice changes over the years, for people to be up to date. And we know that weaning, introducing solid foods, is such an important part of a baby's development, that I think this is great that we are sharing this message beyond parents, potentially to grandparents and great grandparents as well.
That's wonderful. And how important is nutrition to newborn babies?
Well, I mean, we know there's research that looks at what we call the first 1,001 days of life, which is essentially from conception right up until a child's second birthday. And there's a huge amount of research into this area now. So it's all fairly new stuff. But we know that actually what we feed children and what children eat and what they experience in those very early years are so important in terms of their long term health and building those foundations of health and, you know, acceptance of lots of food. So advice has changed quite a lot recently, and it's just because we've got so much scientific research that looks at this area, and we know that it's a really, really key milestone to try and get things right, essentially, with young babies.
And of course, new mothers think they know best, and of course, granny and great granny are put to one side. But what's the advice for people in those positions? Should they listen to the new mother, or just make the point that we've done it already?
I think the thing to bear in mind is that everybody has the best interest of the child at heart. And I think a situation that often occurs is that when the NHS's advice has changed over the years, grandparents, you know, they've got all that experience, they've brought up children, they've done a great job. And the advice back then might be different to what the advice is now. And the parents might be looking at, you know, being advised by their GP and their health visitor to do it slightly differently. And I think that can create a lot of confusion. And alongside this campaign that we're talking about today, which is the Start for Life weaning campaign, there's been some surveys done. And the advice from the NHS when it comes to introducing solid foods is that the right time to do it for most babies is around 6 months. But this survey found that 40% of first-time mums were actually introducing solid foods significantly earlier than that. 40% were introducing before 5 months. 3 in 5, around 60% of first-time parents, found the decision to start weaning confusing. And after partners, it was grandmothers, actually, who they said were the biggest influence on decision-making, with over a quarter of first-time mums saying that their mother have been their biggest influence on their decision to start weaning. So what ends up happening is, I think a parent can get quite confused because the NHS guidance is saying to introduce solids around 6 months. And that is, as Charlotte said, based on all of the evidence and data and science that we have now, which is loads. But it used to be different. And I think the advice used to be that weaning could be done earlier than that. So parents are getting a bit confused. So this is why it's important that we are sharing this message, not just with parents, but with grandparents as well, who can go and have a look at the latest advice and the up-to-date advice on the Start for Life Weaning Hub. And then everybody's singing from the same hymn sheet.
Yeah, completely. I completely agree with Zoe there. I think that's such good points. And yeah, parents are confused as well. So I think, you know, you can take a bit of advice, but the advice has changed recently. And that's really the key thing here. We're trying to get this message out that this is all up to date advice based on scientific research. And it's all NHS backed too.
And where can people get more guidance and advice? Is there somewhere online?
Yeah, so if you search for Start for Life and then go on to the Weaning Hub, which is on that page. So Start for Life is a government programme, and it basically helps to give parents all the information that they need about how to go about introducing solid foods, even including when to start, what foods to avoid, what to do about allergies. So there's loads and loads of information, and you just need to search for Start for Life and it should come up, and you can then access the Weaning Hub directly from there.
Charlotte and Dr. Zoe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Chris.
Thank you.
On 97.2 FM and online at radioreverb.com, this is Radio Reverb. And you're listening to At Home This Morning, a programme for older listeners.
Now, if you were offered more money and a promotion to move jobs, but it involved travelling from Brighton to, say, London every day, would you do it? Well, a lot of people, of course, in the past, it was a no-brainer. It was something you had to do. But we're told now that a lot of people would rather query that. And joining us to discuss that, Sabine van der Landen and David Shepherd. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Chris.
Morning, Chris.
And thank you very much for joining us. And is it really the case that people have got so used to working at home from their bedroom or wherever it may be that they don't want to go into a full-time job?
Yeah, I think the past 2 years have created a shift, and employees have seen what is possible, you know, from working from a remote location, whether that be home or just a location of choice. They've seen how productive they can be. They've seen that their work isn't affected in any way. So it's very much now, as we are approaching a world that is potentially going to ask employees to go to certain locations, we're seeing a world where the employees are questioning that.
Sabine, what's your view?
Well, my view, Chris, is that we've seen that employees are looking for more work-life balance, and they want choice. And they want more flexibility in the way they schedule their own task. And one of the stats I love mentioning is, you know, for people traveling from Brighton to the central of London, it can take, you know, 1 to 2 hours per day of commuting. So imagine 5 to 10 hours of commutes per week. So, you know, being able to shed that away, I'm sure a lot of people would welcome that. And reuse that with their family by balancing the work with their personal lives.
And of course, traveling by train or however you choose to travel to London is not inexpensive. I mean, a season ticket, I gather, is about £5,000 a year. So that's got to come out of your salary before you start living, really.
It's a very good point, Chris, and it's something we've recently conducted a study called the Everywhere Workplace, where we've asked people, what are the positives or maybe the negatives of, you know, working from anywhere? And actually 48% immediately called out that there was time saved with less commuting, but also 40% hit your point there exactly, which, hey, we're saving money. We're able to do what we do and we're saving money.
And do you think it's going to mean the end of huge tower blocks full of people working away in offices?
I don't think so, Chris, actually. I think you will still need people working in offices, but I see it being more hybrid. So one point the Everywhere Workplace study also highlight is the themes around hybrid engagement, where some people will work from offices, others will work remotely, and some will actually have the balance between the two, enabling them to still have the water cooler chat if they want some days of the week.
And David, your view?
Yeah, exactly the same. Hybrid, as Sabine mentioned, 42% want to embrace the hybrid working, which helps combat some of the negatives of, you know, a lack of collaboration or a lack of FaceTime. So having an employee experience where, yeah, some days I work in a remote location, maybe home. Other times I'm going to a team meeting or I just want to be around colleagues and get that interaction that I miss if I'm completely virtual. So yes, very much so.
One of the questions that comes to mind is that you lose the interaction between people that you naturally get if you're working in the same spot, whereas you don't if you're remote. Is that really true, or is that a figment of people's imagination?
I would say it's a figment, Chris, but I do work mostly remotely with my team. And because a lot of the organization we work with are intentionally located, you have to get used to this fluid and transient working style. What you need, though, to make this work is highly effective collaborative tools, which enables employees and teams to effectively engage. So what we see maybe better use and more usage of, you know, onboarding tools, you know, whiteboarding tools, digital cloud tools, which enables you to build a full internal employee experience, which allows you therefore to enable those who prefer to work remotely to be efficient and effective and still take care, you know, of their work and families at the same time.
So you think that working will continue, albeit changed dramatically in the next few months?
Yes, definitely. I think next month, maybe slightly longer as the everywhere workplace evolves. If we get the technology right, to Sabine's point, if employers can create environments where the experience is always the same and it's always secure for the individual, then we can work from everywhere. There will always be roles that need to have more office time, maybe more than remote time, but then there's a flip to that as well. And as long as the solutions are around the employee to make that happen, then the employees get a good experience. And as we move forward, we will stop talking about everywhere workplaces because it will just become the normality of how we work.
Sabine van der Laan, David Shepherd, we're providing some post-pandemic options of workplace choices you might like to consider. Although we can't usually include last-minute items in At Home This Morning, the current situation in the Ukraine, of course, changes everything. Here with news of a special event in his own village is our Rottingdean correspondent, Chris Harris.
Yes, thanks, Chris. I've been talking to local Rottingdean actor Tom Kotcher, who's producing a rather wonderful show in aid of the Ukraine appeal.
This was, about just over 3 weeks ago. I was watching television, watching the harrowing scenes that were coming in from Ukraine, and I felt useless. I thought, what can I do? I mean, I'm 71-year-old. I'd be a liability over there. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. Last year, we put on a charity show called A Bit of a Do to raise money for the Actors Benevolent Fund, Maurice Thorogood, another fellow actor and director myself. And we raised, I think it was £1,350 plus. And I thought, I wonder. So I phoned Maurice and I said, look, how's about putting on an event to raise money for the Ukraine appeal? He said, absolutely, great idea. Let's do it. Well, that was just over 3 weeks ago. So I got in touch with the lovely Heather Butler, the church warden. She said, phone Father Anthony if that's what you want to do in the church, you see. And I did. Well, what I did was I sent him a message and I hit the thing send, walked through to the kitchen, put the kettle on, and the phone rang. Hello, Tom, I'm Father Anthony. Yes, of course you can. So we've got St. Margaret's Church in Rottingdean. It's on the 2nd of April, Saturday. It's at 7 o'clock. It's we're going to call it Hope for Ukraine. Whether the war is finished or whether or not there's so many people who are still in dire need, some have left Ukraine with nothing, so any monies that come in will be greatly received. We've got it's an evening of Ukrainian and Slavic music and poetry. Now, so Morris and I got together and we started to look at what we had to do. So we looked at things like poetry. So we're on Google getting Ukrainian poets and all this, and that was fine. And then the music, yes, we got bits of that. And then we suddenly realised it's all coming together rather fast. And we've got the poster. And what we don't have is a musician. And that was slightly worrying after seeing an evening of music. Rather funny, I don't know. I went into the church anyway to look around and to see how we're going to stage it. And I sat down in a pew and I looked up and I said to the big guy up there, I said, I need some musicians. And I never thought anything of it. Within 2 days, I had the Priory String Quartet. I had their lovely violinist, Sophia Bartlett, and another violinist, Mina May Alexander, and they all contacted and said, we'd love to be there. So we now have the full band, if you like, and we'll be playing Ukrainian and Slavic music. And, of course, my wife also, she's an actress, she'll be there and reciting poetry along with myself and Morris and talking in between the music about the various composers. So it should be a great evening, but there's something else, because what Father Anthony says was, on the Friday, that's the night before, they were having a do, and are having a do, which at the church, which is to raise money for the church funds. But he said, instead, that money will go to the Ukrainian Appeal, as will the collection on Sunday during the service. And so, but please go, come along to ours. It's £10 at the door. And to Father Anthony's evening, which is Singing in the Rain, which is the movie being shown, but it's also got all the words of the songs, and you're encouraged to sing along to the songs. It's going to be a fantastic night. So both nights, folks, please think about coming along and help those in Ukraine who are desperate for your support.
Something you said earlier, it's quite surprised me. Who's going to be reading Ukrainian poetry?
Well, we are, but it'll be in English. I can assure you of that.
And I notice on the flyer there that there are beverages available.
Oh, yes, yes, we've been very lucky. Butler's Wine Cellar from Kemp Town, Cassie and Henry, have been fantastic again. They're selling the wine to us at cost price. So that we make maximum profit on the wine, which will again go to the Ukrainian Appeal. And Father Anthony says the church will pay for that wine. This is a village with such a big heart, and we're knocked out by that. And also Budgeons, our local store, Tammy, the manageress, says, yes, whatever soft drinks you want, have them on us. So we're covered in that area. Now, with the wine, by the way, we're not selling it per se at, say, £3, £5 a glass, whatever it is. What we're saying is it's donations only. So if you don't have much, don't give much. And if you have a lot, I'll leave you with that thought. Thank you.
The show is on Saturday, the 2nd of April, at St Margaret's Church in Rottingdean, and gets underway at 7 p.m. So might be a good idea to get there a little earlier to get a good seat. £10 entrance and pay on the door.
Thanks, Chris. Now, as our 60 minutes of airtime are nearly up, it's just about enough time for me to tell you about a show that's coming to the Theatre Royal, which should be right up your street if you're a musical theatre fan like me. It's the Carole King musical called Beautiful, and many of Carole's best-known numbers are included. Amongst them, Up on the Roof, You've Lost That Loving Feeling, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, and of course You've Got a Friend. And so, until we next meet over the airwaves, or however you listen, please don't forget that my co-presenter Richard Davis will be here with his next edition in a couple of weeks' time. For the past hour, you've been listening to At Home This Morning, which is a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb. And of course, you can listen again to a selection of some of the editions of the show by entering either Radio Reverb or Grey Matters Productions, CIC, into your internet browser, selecting the Listen Again tab, and then just choosing the actual show or shows you'd like to hear again. And so until we next meet again, this is Chris English signing off with, as usual, my plea for you all to please keep safe and well. And remember that as COVID-19 cases are increasing once again in Brighton and Hove, please don't forget to wear your masks when you're in crowded places or on public transport. Bye for now.